But for now, let's get to our guest in this segment. She is Peggy Little, Senior Litigation Counsel for the National Civil Liberties Alliance at NCLA Legal. And Peggy, first thing I got to ask you about that Twitter handle of yours, Trink44. What is that all about?
Well, it's a very obscure message from a writer I really like a lot. Actually, of Shakespeare's time, a Frenchman called François Rabelais. And Trink is the magic word at the end of his great book. So
oh,
I just adopted it from that.
I love it. I think that's fantastic. So, Peggy, it was a busy week on Capitol Hill. And it's going to be another couple busy weeks. I don't ever remember Congress and the Senate being this busy 16 days out before an election. But they're taking care of the business for the people for once. And the first item I want to talk to you about is Amy Coney Barrett. First of all, just tell my audience why, in your opinion, which I believe you have one on this, is Amy Coney Barrett qualified to be on the Supreme Court?
She's superbly qualified, and I don't say that lightly. I had read a lot of very superlative things about her, but I am a skeptic by nature. Mm-hmm. So I read almost every one of her opinions, her publications, and came away with enormous respect for her intellect, the care with which she makes decisions, the attention to detail, her open-mindedness, her commitment to doing justice, and her very careful reasoning and analysis of the text. It's really outstanding judicial opinions that do qualify her for this seat on the court.
And Peggy, let's talk about that word textualist. We heard that a lot this week. We heard a lot of terms that many Americans may not be completely familiar with. I actually happen to be a recovering attorney, so I was familiar with them. Constitutional law was one of my favorite classes. I was a prosecuting attorney, and then I worked for 20 years in the private sector before I jumped into politics, and now I'm on radio, so here we are. So I understood what they were saying, but a lot of Americans may have been like, okay, what's an originalist? What's a textualist? And, you know, more importantly, what are the opposite of those words? She was very gentle, I thought, and very kind in how she would describe the opposites of those words. I would call it activism or an activist judge. She used the word pragmatist. Could you define those terms? Basically, those, and I know there's a lot of gray area, and we have a lot of judges that tend to be swing voters over the years. Justice John Roberts is starting to become quite the swing voter on the court. But in a vacuum, textualist slash originalist versus activist slash pragmatist on the Supreme Court. What do folks mean by that?
Well, a textualist looks at the text of whether it's the Constitution or statute or regulation, and does their level best to apply the words, the original meaning of those words, as they meant at the time the statute, text, or Constitution was adopted. And so, for example, with the 14th Amendment, that might be in the 1860s. With the Constitution, of course, it's 1789, the later amendments, et cetera. So it's not just fixed in time in the 18th century. It's fixed in time whenever Congress passes a statute. And an originalist says you have to stick to the original public meaning of those words, whereas those who believe in you define them as activists. They sometimes also call themselves believers in a living constitution. That means one where the meaning changes over time. You probably remember this from law school, Tim. They find penumbras and mm-hmm. emanations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot of fancy words. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and whenever you see a penumbra or an emanation, look out, because somebody is legislating from the bench.
That's the key, isn't it? And so, Peggy, what do you say to folks? And the example that always jumps into my mind is it typically has to do with like the Second Amendment, right? So they'll say, well, you know, you can't be a textualist or an originalist because that's old-fashioned. That's old foginess. That doesn't work because, you know, things evolve and history evolves. And, you know, back in the day in the 1700s, the founders, they never imagined that we would have firearms this advanced, that there would be automatic or semi-automatic weapons and the force and the velocity and all that. You know, they all had, you know, single-loader muskets, and you know, maybe one or two of the richer folks had revolvers, but you know, we have to change with the times. So what is? But I bet there's a very good legal response to that because the founders did have a lot of foresight and vision, didn't they?
They certainly did, and they understood what a firearm was, and so do we. Now, the jurisprudence under the Second Amendment, including Justice Scalia's, does not ban all reasonable regulation of firearms. It just insists that there is an individual right to bear arms and to defend oneself. And that is an important Second Amendment right. For years, the folks on the left were trying to say, well, that really applies only to a militia, which is a good example of a misreading, an atextual reading of the Second Amendment. And one of the great things that Justice Scalia did was restore that original meaning of the Second Amendment that meant that there is an individual right to bear arms.
How dangerous is it that the left has turned the definition, as they often do, of court packing completely on its head to suggest that now they argue that it's court packing to even think about nominating someone to the bench when there's a vacancy. I don't care, you know, what time or place it is, but, you know, there's a vacancy on the Supreme Court, just like there might be a vacancy in some of the lower courts. So they're calling filling that vacancy because they don't like the timing of it. Court packing, I guess, to possibly, you know, dog whistle, I'll use one of their favorite phrases, dog whistle this sense to their hardest core supporters that we're going to call it that so then we can go and actually do real court packing and use this as an excuse. It's very dangerous to the function of the Supreme Court as what it's supposed to be, which I believe many of our forefathers like Adams and Jefferson and so forth intended it to be the weakest branch of government. I think Hamilton specifically wrote about that in the Federalist Papers.
The least dangerous branch is the judiciary. Yes, you're absolutely correct about that. This is to call filling a vacancy when a justice dies while the president is still in office and the Senate is controlled by the party that is the same party as the president is a complete misnomer. That is not court packing. Interestingly, Joe Biden it was called the Biden rule. And when earlier vacancies opened up and he was scared that a Republican, that a Democrat might not get in, he proposed exactly what took place here. And it's interesting that Joe Biden has been quite quiet. And I think it's because he went public with the statement that he thought that the seats should be filled while the Democratic president was still in office. So that's a complete misuse of the term court packing. Court packing, as you know well, Tim, is something that was threatened by Franklin Roosevelt to stop the judges on the Supreme Court from overturning some of his most controversial legislation. And it was immediately denounced. The public at that time, this would be in the 1930s, was outraged that a president would think he could pack the court with his true believers and then change the balance of power between the three branches. Fortunately, he did not pursue that plan because it was so roundly denounced by people of all parties. And it's never seriously been revived until just recently, and that's because of the Democrats' bitter disappointment about when this seat opened up.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Back to Amy Coney Barrett. Could you tell our audience what dig deeper a little bit into her judicial philosophy, maybe with some cases that she is perhaps famous for in the legal circles for writing? You know, tell us a little bit more about her philosophy. It's no doubt she's brilliant, right? We all got to see that develop over 3 days. I think with the media and the left, we were all prepared, maybe not prepared, but they were trying to prepare us that we were going to see some outlandish, bizarre, cartoonish figure. I mean, how weird is it that this woman is she's got 7 kids and she's like this ultra-Orthodox Catholic. I think people are expecting like a Martian to land or something. Turns out she was incredibly charming. She was incredibly bright. She answered questions for 3 days straight with 0 notes in front of her. Her recall was amazing. She's quoting chapter and verse back to these senators. I remember the exchange with Senator Klobuchar, right, where Klobuchar is trying to trip her up on this particular opinion versus that, and Amy Coney Barrett with 0 notes is actually correcting her on the specific language of these opinions. It was just remarkable. So what's she known for? And then if you can think of something, my understanding is she's not going to act as a, quote, Republican judge. So there's been some decisions out there that maybe Republicans might not be happy with, but that she has written as a textualist, as an originalist. She's not supposed to worry about public opinion. She's just supposed to apply the facts to the law.
Correct. I think your listeners would be very interested in a case called Doe versus Purdue. That's a case where a young student at Purdue University in Indiana was charged with sexual assault in one of these Title IX investigations. He was completely denied due process. Not only was he not able to present a defense or witnesses to speak on his behalf, but he was told by the Title IX committee at Purdue that they held that the accuser's allegations were deemed more credible than his. Only the panel had never heard from the woman. It was only a secondhand account, and they had not allowed the student to present his own defense. It was a complete deprivation of due process. And she very carefully went through that young man's complaint. She didn't cut him any breaks. If you read it, it's kind of a suspenseful decision. You don't know who's going to win, right? Mm-hmm. But she did find that his due process rights had been arguably violated, and that case stayed alive. This is an important area because the Title IX investigations on campuses are out of control. Mm-hmm. It's something mm-hmm. that my organization, the New Civil Liberties Alliance, has a great interest in college campuses. There's another case where she recognizes that the protections that are often given to out-of-control government actors will not immunize them from liability. And that's another really important field. She shows great craft and seriousness in approaching her work. As you also said, she had enormous recall and was able to correct senators about the things they were saying about her cases, which were simply not accurate. She showed a great deal of grace, conviction, and she was uncommonly well-poised in her questioning.
Speaking to Peggy Little, she is the senior litigation counsel for NCLA, which is the New Civil Liberties Alliance. You can follow them at NCLA Legal. And they truly are recognizing the threat of the administrative state. And that is that fourth rail of government we don't know about that pushes down on us all the time. Peggy, last question for you. A lot of focus on the terror that the left is experiencing over the fact that Amy Coney Barrett could be the decisive vote on diminishing Roe v. Wade or even overturning it. We keep hearing that she's going to throw all these millions of Americans off health care if she finds in one of these cases against Obamacare, which has already been largely dismantled, but, you know, it's still kind of a skeleton wandering around, a little meat on its bones. You know, Peggy, if a case has been cited wrong, this issue of stare decisis or res judicata, basically, that is a doctrine. Those are doctrines, but they don't mean that the law can never be changed. I mean, we've got a lot of notorious situations in our country where we had improper, unfair, unconstitutional laws on the books. You know, the right of women, you know, not to vote, slavery. If you believe Democrats that you never change anything, then just because some people depend on it, well, then those things might still exist. But thank goodness we had judges who did change those things. So if something's wrong, Peggy, if Roe v. Wade was decided wrongly, and a lot of legal scholars, I've even read some on the left who think that it was a horribly constructed opinion, issues about Obamacare, if they're wrong, Peggy, if they're unconstitutional, it's the duty of a Supreme Court judge to find them so, isn't it?
Of course it is. We wouldn't have, we would still have segregated schools if the court in Brown v. Board of Education had not been willing to overturn Plessy v. Ferguson, the case that allowed for such segregation. It was essential to the civil rights of Americans to have the Brown v. Board of Education case. So she has written about stare decisis. She does not approach it with recklessness. She understands the importance of generally trying to follow law and not disturb precedent. But the conclusion is, as it must be from anyone, that there's no such thing as a case that cannot be overturned if it's wrong. Mm-hmm. It must be overturned.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And Roe v. Wade, by the way, has very few defenders. In fact, Justice Ginsburg was critical of that case, something few people remember.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Despite the media massive meltdown and the punditry on this, you're absolutely right. The legal scholars, you're correct. There's very few defenders of that. Peggy Little, Senior Litigation Counsel at NCLA, at NCLA Legal. You can follow Peggy at Trink44. Thank you very much, Peggy, for joining us tonight, for all that incredibly incredibly deep legal information that you boiled down that I believe the audience could absolutely follow us throughout that conversation. So thanks, Peggy, for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tim.